It has been more than 50 years since Steely Dan released its first album, 1972's Can't Buy a Thrill. Steely Dan was founded by the late Walter Becker, who was born in Queens, and New Jersey native Donald Fagen. The two shared credit on almost every single Steely Dan song. Steely Dan's footprint is large and its impact on pop culture is undeniable. Like in this episode of The Sopranos, where Tony is singing along while driving.
I'm a fool to do your dirty work. Oh, yeah. I don't want to do your dirty work no more.
And you know you're part of the pop culture canon when you get a snarky shout out on The Simpsons. Here's Homer.
Attention, lovers of studio perfectionism. I've drugged all the concessions, so you'll do what I say.
Drugs at a Steely Dan concert? I never thought I'd see the day.
Yeah, that last voice was Steely Dan co-founder Donald Fagen himself. Recently, there was an article in Time Out London titled, Why is Everyone in London Obsessed with Steely Dan Right Now? Part of the answer lies in the band's ability to deliver hooks that are earworms and are sample-friendly, helping the music live on, like in a pre-problematic Kanye's hit, Champion. And when you pop the hood on the lyrics, you enter another world. Their songs refer to things like squonks and people like the Dandy of Gamma Chi and Chino and Daddy Gee. Gee or G?
G.
Thank you. It's this side of Steely Dan that is explored in the new illustrated book of essays called Quantum Criminals, Ramblers, Wild Gamblers, and Other Soul Survivors from the Songs of Steely Dan. It provides a roadmap through the world of Steely Dan and its influences. It's incredibly thorough and often hilarious book. Joining me now is author Alex Papademos. Alex, welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
Also in studio with us is Joan LeMay, who did the illustrations. Hi, Joan.
Hi.
Alex, how do you describe Steely Dan?
Perfectionist studio wizard duo of the 1970s who improbably survived into the 2000s and beyond. And I think you can still go see them to this day. They will be touring forever. Improbably long-lived 70s legends.
Would you read a sample from your book so people can get the tone and the flavor?
I sure would. Donald and Walter began the process of accepting that they were old men when they were barely 30, which is the smartest way to do it, because if you're efficient about it, you can get right with your youth's impermanence before it actually starts to skate away. In their 20s, Donald and Walter wrote lyrics about children who scream and run wild and wondered, why do I tremble each time they ride by? And near the end of the 70s, they wrote the mordantly funny Hey 19 about no longer being able to talk to women just a decade younger than them due to cultural differences they perceived as fundamental. On their reunion tours, they seemed to relish having finally actually become the leathery, cynical show business lifers they'd presented themselves as for years. And on their reunion albums, they finally sound as old and weird as they've always claimed to feel.
When the writing is great, when did you know you wanted to have a visual element?
You know, I mulched on a proposal for a Steely Dan book that would have contained many of these same ideas for like a year and a half and kind of didn't know where I was going with it. I knew that I had like thoughts about this band and never got tired of talking about them. But it wasn't until Joan sort of announced, soft launched the idea of doing a zine, of drawing all of these characters that one of the editors of this book, Jessica Hopper, and I both started texting each other like, that's a great rubric and structure for a Steely Dan book. And once we had that one big idea, everything kind of just snapped into place. And it didn't take very long to write it once I finally got around to it.
Joan, what interested you about this project?
Well, I'm a lifelong Steely Dan fan.
There you go.
And I also, I love making art in series. And this was sort of early pandemic times. I made a spreadsheet of every named Steely Dan character. And it was 200, and it was biblical in proportion. And so it was something that I could immerse myself in that was going to take a very long time. And I had just sort of started that project for myself. I've been envisioning these characters in one way or another, if not specifically, then sort of spiritually my whole life.
Alex, you and Joan did a Reddit Ask Me Anything a few days ago. And one of the questions was a very, you know, I won't say obvious, but important one. what inspired you to write the book. And you said, I never get tired of listening to them and thinking about them and talking about them. Writing is hard, and some portion of the time you spend writing a book is always going to suck. But I knew I wouldn't get sick of the subject matter, even in the depths of the process suck zone. So what is it about Steely Dan that made you want to write about them, and why wouldn't you get stuck in the suck zone?
I think that there's endless ambiguity and endless room to imagine and fill in the gaps, because Donald and Walter left out so much. That was the sort of the essence of their art, is giving you just that little snippet. They talked about it like being in New York City and overhearing the conversation of someone passing you in the other direction in a song like Through With Buzz, like those weird, then you come away from it with this weird anecdote. You're like, why were they saying that? And I feel like that's what Steely Dan's songs give you, is just that little piece of something that kind of fires your imagination. And there was just so much to chase after and kind of dig out. Mm-hmm. And I think that was, you know, that was the main thing. I mean, I think that, you know, that sort of sums up what I said on Reddit. I did not expect to have that quoted back to me. That is very much in my Reddit vernacular and not my WNYC voice.
We're talking about Quantum Criminals, Ramblers, Wild Gambers, and Gamblers, and other soul survivors from the songs of Steely Dan. My guests are author Alex Papademos and illustrator Joan LeMay. So, you know, some people are real, like Ricky from Ricky Don't Lose the Numbers, a real person. Mm-hmm. Did you see a picture of Ricky?
Sure
did. Tell me about your Ricky research.
Yeah, the Ricky research, just like all the other pictorial research, was just deep, deep Googling. So much Googling. And it was, I made up her body. I made up her outfit. I had, when I was painting all of these characters, I had a folder on my desktop that was called the Dan Casting Gallery. Mm. And it was filled with found photos, photos of friends, photos of family, pictures from sewing catalogs and clothing catalogs from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. And I would compile images through those reference points.
Tell us about Ricky.
Ricky's name was Ricky Ducournet. She really did, I think, get Donald's number. I think Donald gave it to her. I don't know if she asked for it. I think she may have lost it on purpose because she was in a relationship at the time. But it's an amazing story because she leaves the country for a while. They meet at Bard College when Donald is a student there, and she's, I think, married to a faculty member. And then she goes off, leaves the country for a while, and comes back, and there's a hit song with her name in it all over the radio. And she's talked about how she would hear it at certain moments, and it would always seem to be calling to her in moments of confusion or feeling lost or something. Huh. It would come on in the airport or the supermarket or something like that. And it also, that song created a notable demographic uptick for like kids born in the 70s, girls born in the 70s being named Ricky. Like, you can actually see it in the census records.
So actually the first person, Ricky's a little farther into the book, but the first person is Jack.
Yes.
Who we introduce, as in you go back, Jack, do it again. I'll let the song actually play rather than me singing it.
In the morning you go gunning for the man who stole your
All right, I'm going to describe your Jack a little bit, Joan, and you can dive in. So Jack is sitting there in your illustration, cards in front of him, bottle of Jack Daniels, mm-hmm. balding guy, looking kind of sad, looking depressed, got a cardigan on. Tell us about your rendition of Jack. How did you come to this Jack?
I wanted Jack to be a dejected figure.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted him to look tired. I wanted him to look like he'd been trying very hard, but also not so dejected that he wasn't going to get back up and sort of
do it again.
He's an archetype. He's like the fool in the tarot, you know, and he's you and he's me, and there, he's a real guy.
You write that Jack is a Steely Dan protagonist.
Yeah, an archetypal Steely Dan protagonist, because he keeps making the same mistakes, and he's maybe telling himself a story about how he's not doing that, mm-hmm. and this time he's going to win, you know? He's going back to the table. But it's like, it's the very first song on the very first Steely Dan album, and it's kind of the archetypal Steely Dan protagonist, because he's somebody who, he evades hanging, he's in some kind of a Wild West mm-hmm. scenario, you know, stealing people's water, and then he's at the table, sort of, and one time after time, he seems to play into fate's hands and then somehow escape from it. And they would tell that story over and over again in different forms, like throughout their career.
Joan, did you have one particular person you were excited to draw? Jack, Peg, Dr. Wu, Cousin Dupree. Was there one that you were just like, I'm ready?
I was so pumped to paint Kathy Barbarian as soon as you know, she was someone who I had not done a lot of research on previously. And when we started digging into the book and started learning more and I saw images of her, I was like, oh yeah, caftan time. She was, I wanted her to just be regal and magical. And she was a delight.
Can you put her in context for people?
Yes. She's an avant-garde opera singer who worked with John Cage and a bunch of other folks and was peerless with what she did and would make these crazy compositions using all kinds of sounds and mm-hmm. automatopoeia. And she just appears in one line of one song, but boy.
Can I put you on the spot what the line is?
Even Kathy Barbarian knows there's one roulade she can't sing because mm-hmm. she could sing anything. And so the joke is that even Kathy Barbarian, it's like, you know, the can't pull the sword from the stone. And a roulade is something. This is why I have not written a book about Kathy Barbarian, because I couldn't tell you what a roulade is. So in that sense, there is a dessert, but there's also a musical term. It means something. But yeah, she was an amazing singer who had every, you know, incredible range and incredible, you know, voice. And so the joke is that, you know, I think the joke is that Donald Fagen is a very limited vocalist and thought of himself as a very limited vocalist. And it's funny to imagine him invoking Kathy Barbarian.
Yes.
So that is a very specific detail.
That's a deep cut.
Yes. Yeah. What is a detail from your research, Alex, which really did help you sort of, you know, stay focused on what the mission of the project was? You know, sometimes you get a detail and you can put it like on a post-it note and you put it on your bulletin board so you know, like, this is what this is about.
I think the post-it it's not a real post-it, but it's a mental post-it. Mm-hmm. And the one that is most important, I think, is don't try to be funnier than Donald and Walter. Because if you are a Steely Dan fan, if you have read their writings like in the sort of the early aughts internet when they resurfaced and sort of were blogging pretty regularly or their liner notes or even really their interviews, like they're just effortlessly funny and incredibly intellectual and yet hilarious. And there were points where I was like, I'm not going to outdo them. I need to just go straight down the middle on this because I feel like I'm competing with someone who is uncompete-withable. That's not a word, but you know what I mean.
So when you think about when they're writing their lyrics, were they writing them for themselves? Were they writing them for the super fan?
Each other, yeah. I think. Yes. I think that you're listening to two very smart, very funny, very acerbic guys who kind of found their soulmate in college. I think that these are two guys who are absolutely made for one another. And it's maybe, I think, like Walter is the only person kind of darker than Donald in some ways. And so that's their, you know, that's their bond. And I think that they were just making each other laugh. It was the number one priority throughout this artistic process. And basically, like, when Walter has to take some time off, that's the end of Steely Dan mm-hmm. for a long time. And Donald has to relearn how to write for his solo records. And they're very different as a result.
Yes. What is a squonk?
Oh, the squonk.
As heard in any major dude.
Yes, as heard in any major dude. The squonk, it turns out, is a mythological character that is rumored. There are roots in Pennsylvania folklore, and it's a creature that looks kind of like a cross between a Shar Pei and a deflated elephant, and it's described as having warts and all kinds of unseemly things on its skin, and it's so sad that it looks the way that it does, that it cries and cries and cries. And the squonk cries so much that he dissolves into a puddle of himself. And he was fun to paint, but he was also sad to paint. Like I couldn't, you know, when I was working, I had paintings around my area and I couldn't look at the squonk because you just want to hug the squonk, even though, you know, he would be squishy.
I just keep thinking drugs. I just do.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's the safest interpretation. If you don't know what something is, it's probably drugs.
Absolutely.
It's probably a metaphor for drugs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here are two takes on Steely Dan from two different, very different prolific record producers. A couple months ago, Steve Albini, who's like sort of the cool kid producer, Nirvana, the Pixies, just went on this Twitter thread that included a lot of words you can't say on radio about Steely Dan and wrote, "Christ, the amount of human effort wasted to sound like an SNL band warm-up." The counterpoint was Mark Ronson, sort of the groove-making machine. He tweeted, "Just realized Donald Fagen wasn't even 30 when Steely Dan dropped Asia. Happy birthday to our Lord of irony-imbued super jams." Why do you think Steely Dan is polarizing?
I think, let me say that I love that Steve Albini is holding this position, and I don't ever want him to change his mind. I would be disappointed in him
yes.
if he got on the Steely Dan bus at this point. I want him on the big black bus and the PJ Harvey
right,
bus
yes.
and the, you know, the noise bus, the shellac bus. Like that's what I want from Steve, because I love that he's, in his own way, such a perfectionist and so much about, like, there is one right way to do things, and so are Steely Dan, but they otherwise could not be further apart aesthetically. And I sort of, I love that about him. And there is something about, you know, I came of age in the time, though, where Steve Albini's take was much more the prevailing
mm-hmm.
take. I am a late Gen X person. I am, you know, in the alt-rock years growing up. There was nothing more uncool than Steely Dan. And I kind of feel like that kept them safe for me to discover later on, because the sort of retro industrial complex like didn't get a hold of them until much later, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
We've really strip mined
yeah.
all the cool rock and roll from the 60s and 70s and kind of hollowed it out and, you know, kind of, you know, made it sort of embarrassing now. But there's something about Steely Dan. They were sort of freeze dried from that point. And so you could sort of find them like a secret, because if other than like about six or seven big classic rock radio hits, like nobody really, you know, paid attention to what was going on those records, at least nobody my age.
Mm-hmm.
And so it felt like I was discovering them when I found them. But yeah, I mean, I think like people like Mark Ronson, like now you're seeing you know, the result, like later generations digging into this music without the same aesthetic prejudices and kind of figuring out that there's so much to mine here, both musically and lyrically, you know, aesthetically,
mm-hmm.
all of that.
Did your relationship with Steely Dan change over the course of this project, Joan?
If anything, it deepened, just in the way that whenever you start peeling the onion on something you love, mm-hmm. You the more you learn, the greater your
mm-hmm.
your appreciation is. And throughout the course of making the book, Alex and I would have Monday morning calls where we'd talk about ideas, and he'd always be going down some sort of wormhole that I would follow him into, and it was just a joy and a delight.
Let's listen to a sample of Peg, which is from De La Soul's I Know, and we can talk about it really quickly on the other side.
In this world of lust that I have for you, it's true, true.
I know I love you better.
So, Alex, why are they one of the most widely sampled bands?
Because, yeah, they had the best players. They were, you know, it was two guys who basically, after a certain point, were just shuttling session musicians in and out of the studio all day long until they got what they wanted. And everybody wanted to play on these Steely Dan records. And so all of these incredible players showed up on these albums, and then years later, like, as you know, like DJs looking for samples, like when you don't know if something's going to be dope or not, you can check for players and sort of see who's on there and be like, oh, Steve Gadd, like, oh, you know, whatever. Like, this is like, all of these people are heavy hitters. And so like you can kind of look at that aspect of it. And so I think it's just like an incredible fount of sampleable groove, because there are all of these like incredible musicians who often didn't get to play on stuff this complicated and interesting and really like stretch out and bring their ideas to it. And I think like as much as their reputation for perfectionists is true, for being perfectionists is true, Steely Dan also like wanted the best ideas that these people had and kind of like let them off the leash in a way that, you know, like you would go and do a dog food commercial in the morning and then play on a Steely Dan record at night. And like that was your, you know, that was your treat after like, do, you know, working your kind of, you know, day job in some ways.
The book is a great read, and it's also beautiful to look at. It is called Quantum Criminals, Ramblers, Wild Gamblers, and Other Soul Survivors from the Songs of Steely Dan. The author and illustrator will be at Unnameable Books in Brooklyn tonight at 7 p.m. If you have questions for them, my guests have been Alex Papademos and Joan LeMay. Thank you so much for coming into the studio, and have a great event tonight.
Thanks so much.
This is all of it.